very exciting for you. Tonight, continuing deep into the night.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, magazines on the Women's Hour, followed by the Center's Solutions Podcast at 11.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 30 with fog. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 10 a.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, I am Herbert Gilmore. This is Prevention Magazine. I'll be reading articles for February 2nd, 2021's episode of Prevention Magazine. The first article is How to See What You Cannot See by Merrill Davids Landau. Everyone, even the best intentioned among us, has unconscious biases deeply ingrained, sometimes subtle prejudices against people who are in marginalized groups or embody a trait with which we don't want to be associated. The key to shedding these preconceptions lies in understanding our own brains. If someone asks you whether people of different genders should be treated equally or black people deserve the same opportunities as white people, odds are you'd say yes. Americans have had strides over the decades in law and in life, reducing overt prejudice against members of society's marginalized groups, even as the rise of white supremacist movements and the increased awareness of police violence against black people showed that we have light years to travel before we achieve full equality. Recently, white Americans seem to have entered a new stage of reckoning with anti-blackness. This is due to the work of black activists who have focused attention on police murders, as well as anti-black rhetoric and violence at Black Lives Matter protests. But the sad truth is that even among people who think themselves as having no prejudices, subtle and more insidious biases remain, in part because they fly under the radar of those who hold them, especially when they are members of a dominant group, white or heterosexual people, for example. These biases involve gender and race, but can also be related to religion, body weight, sexual orientation, physical ability, and many other traits. None of us like to think of ourselves as biased, but no one is immune. Even people who consider themselves incredibly egalitarian are subject to unconscious bias, says Calvin Lai, PhD, an assistant professor of psychological and brain sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Perhaps when you hear a person on TV speaking with a southern accent, you're surprised to learn they're smart. Or if you pass someone with a larger body, you make assumptions about them because of their weight. If you've ever had a gut feeling that a person you've just met wouldn't quite fit your friend group or office culture, implicit bias might have been at work. Close your eyes for a moment and quickly picture a scientist. What came to mind? Do you envision an older white man, maybe with Albert Einstein-esque hair? Default assumptions like this about what kind of person should be a certain role are a form of bias with very real effects. When researchers at Yale University sent professors otherwise identical resumes for a lab position, some with names traditionally associated with men and some with names traditionally associated with women, more of the professors, including those who were women, said they would hire the men, and they offered to pay them more, according to a study published in the journal PNSA. Implicit bias is, of course, especially widespread in the United States when it comes to race and gender. In a subsequent version of the resume study published in Sex Roles, the names of the candidates seem to indicate that applicants were Black, White, Latinx, or Asian. Black women and Latinx women and men were rated lowest in hireability compared with others. The professors reviewing their resumes ranked women of color as less competent than their white counterparts, and both groups were ranked below the men. Other research has uncovered that Black guests on Airbnb are less likely to be approved to rent a property, that preschool-aged Black children are suspended or expelled at up to 4 times the rate of white children, and that people assign a higher value to an object when a white person's hands hold it in it than when it's held by a Black person's hand. For people on the receiving end of bias, the practical and psychological repercussions are vast, harmful, and heartbreaking. Being unfairly rejected by a school can derail a career, and losing out on a job and ending up with a lower pay can lead to a myriad of disadvantages, including reduced access to quality health care. Health care providers have been shown to harbor biases against Black, Latinx, and indigenous people, as well as other people of color, which can result in poorer health outcomes. The fact that these unconscious biases don't involve what members of dominant groups customarily consider overt racism doesn't diminish the devastating effects. The brain is built for bias. Fortunately, with significant determination and effort, we can become aware of our biases and work to eliminate them. Short interventions don't yield long-lasting results, Sly says. Our attempts must be consistent and sustained. Self-monitoring is a part of it, but the bulk of the effort involves recognizing and working to change the culture of systemic racism and discrimination that instill those biases in the first place. See what to turn to. Why is this so challenging? Because in addition to living in a culture that reinforces our biases every single day, we are working against the way our minds naturally function. Human beings regularly take shortcuts in thinking. If we had to ponder everything carefully, from how to dress in the morning to how to perform a work task we've completed thousands of times, we collapse from mental exhaustion. We do such things without thinking. These mental shortcuts can lead to problematic biases because they're often based on discriminatory images or ideas we've seen or heard repeatedly. Implicit biases generally favor the socially dominant group in society, Lai says, and in the United States that often means white people, specifically straight, white, relatively thin, Christian men. So strong is this idea of the norm in our society that members of marginalized groups can have biased thoughts about their peers with similar traits. For example, people in large bodies often think negatively about other large people, says Mary S. Himmelstein, Ph.D., an assistant professor of psychological sciences at Kent State University in Kent, Ohio. And marginalizations build one another. So while white women's ideas may often be ignored in a meeting full of men, a Black woman's are even more likely to be ignored, says Eva Pietre, Ph.D., an assistant professor of psychology at Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis. If that woman is also disabled or lesbian and or has a large body, she is in many settings exponentially more likely to be looked through or mistreated by her less marginalized peers. One way in which experts determine what unconscious biases we have is through a test developed at Harvard known as the Implicit Association Test, IAT, in which subjects are asked to associate images with words as quickly as possible. Concepts linked in memory get categorized faster, says Lai. You can group peanut butter with jelly in less time than linking peanut butter to pickle. These tests consistently find, for instance, a picture of a white person is joined with the word good faster than one of a Black person is joined with the same adjective, especially when the tester is white. You can take the IAT by searching for the Project Implicit online, but bear in mind that it is not necessarily a good measure of an individual's biases so much as of the biases we have in aggregate. Stubborn, but not cemented. Another way to lift the curtain on your hidden prejudices is to honestly examine all parts of your life. If, for no conscious reason, you have no friends of a different race, sexual orientation, or religion than yours, if your office hasn't hired an employee who is disabled, queer, or speaks English with an accent, or even if you're a teacher or a landlord and your favorite students or tenants are people like yourself, it's worth questioning whether implicit biases are at least partly to blame. Unfortunately, becoming aware of biases is not enough to dislodge them. Biased thoughts are sticky because they get reinforced by the world around us, which is fueled by the dominant culture. The conceptualizing of scientists as white men comes from the reality that in the course of history, most have been. Though that's starting to change, Pietri says. Himmelstein notes that fat phobia results from society's widespread, albeit mistaken, notion that body weight is under a person's complete control and that we all wish to be thin, so anyone who can't drop pounds must lack willpower. Actually, many factors including biology and environment are involved in BMI. It's a biased measure of health. Stereotypical images and biased representations exist in advertising, TV shows, movies, song lyrics, what we hear friends and family members say and share on social media, and in many other realms. When societal changes do eventually take hold, however, they can affect our unconscious thoughts rather powerfully. Take sexual orientation. As recently as in 1994, nearly half of Americans said that people who were gay or lesbian shouldn't be accepted by society, a figure that plummeted to 21% in 2019. This change has been mirrored by a drop in implicit bias towards LGBTQ people in the past decade, and with more black actors being cast in roles beyond those of criminals and support staff, our perceptions about race continue to shift, says Lai, since media exposure to black people in positive roles, such as those of athletes and politicians, has been shown to reduce anti-black bias. Still, with limited positive imagery about age and disability, related prejudices have been harder to shake. Prejudice against people of above average weight has increased. How to beat your biases. The most effective way to overcome prejudices is expand your experiences so we're having meaningful interactions with people from diverse backgrounds. When we see people as individuals, the assumptions we have based on group associations fall away, says Lai. This does not mean relying on black or gay or large body friends to teach us. Rather, it's about stepping outside our bubbles, becoming more aware of our thoughts and teaching ourselves to challenge them. But even as we work on that, there are ways right now that we can avoid acting on harmful prejudices. Here's how. Disambiguate. Biases most often show up in ambiguous situations, such as when we first meet someone and don't know a lot about them. That's why in sex roles study, the applicant's qualifications were ambiguous. They had good, but not spectacular, credentials. If one had been a Nobel Prize winner, that person would have had a better chance of being hired, potentially overriding knee-jerk bias, says study co-author Asia Eaton, PhD, an associate professor of psychology at Florida International University in Miami. When we don't know a lot, people may implicitly look to stereotypes to guide their processing, Eaton says. To counter that tendency, do what you can to make ambiguous situations less so. Let's say you're looking to hire an accountant, a lawyer. Decide at the outset the exact criteria you'll use. Set a defined percentage for, say, relevant experience, another fixed amount for personality, etc. So you'll be more likely to stay objective, Eaton suggests. Avoid snap decisions. When overwhelmed or depleted, we don't think as critically, says Lai, and we fall back on stereotypes. Say you're a teacher deciding which two students you'll give a math award to. Do it in the morning when you're rested and less likely to resort to mental shortcuts. Push back against default assumptions. When you do notice reflex judgment pop into your head, challenge it and consciously replace it with a more thought-through opinion. As with toning a muscle, you'll need constant repetition for a lasting effect, Pietro says. Eventually, a new, more accurate vision will override the automatic one. There are many tools at our disposal to help us check ourselves, Lai says. If enough of us deploy them regularly, society will be a much better place for everyone. Where to turn to learn? Experts agree that overcoming biases doesn't happen quickly. Fortunately, There are lots of info about there to help us start to unlearn our culture's most dangerous prejudices, especially anti-blackness. Melinda Weeks Laidlaw Esquire is an organizational consultant and the founder and CEO of Beautiful Ventures, a company that works to normalize black humanity-affirming narratives in pop culture. We asked her to suggest a few things to read, watch, share, and ponder. 1. 5 Ways of Understanding Black Lives Matter, YouTube. This portion of the event Broadway for Black Lives Matter is an engaging 17-minute video on what the BL movement is truly about, presented by NYU professor, activist, and educator Frank Leon Roberts, PhD. 2. Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Black Racist Ideas in America by Ibram X. Kendi is an eye-opening history that chronicles how anti-black concepts were created to rationalize deeply entrenched discriminatory policies and inequities and why they persist. 3. Racial Equity Tools Glossary. racialequitytools.org/glossary. Privilege microaggression, model minority institutional racism. This site provides definitions and explanations for all the terms you'll want to and need to know to understand the conversation surrounding race in America. 4. Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates is a Stern National Book Award winning message to the author's son. The memoir may leave you with a deeper understanding of what it is like to live in this country as a black person. 5. The Black Youth Project. BlackYouthProject.com. Want to know what young people are thinking? BYP is an online publication that amplifies the voices, ideas, and perspectives of black people ages 18 to 30 to empower and mobilize their generation toward activism and social justice leadership. That article was How to See What You Cannot See by Merrill Davids Landau. The next article is Sex and Love, Beyond Intercourse by Rachel Czar, LMFT-CST. We often use the word sex and intercourse interchangeably, but sex is an umbrella term that includes much more than penetration. A distinction many heterosexual couples don't consider until there's an issue with sexual functioning that prevents intercourse. That's when I see them in my office. Maybe the diagnosis is vaginismus, tight muscles in the vaginal walls, or dyspareunia, painful sex with menopause, or difficulty maintaining an erection. When intercourse isn't an option, it can feel like a devastating loss. But what these couples often find as they're working to fix the medical issue is that a whole world of sexual options opens up that may feel even better than what they started with. Reality check. Even for heterosexual couples without physical issues, their reason penis and vagina intercourse may not be the best destination. For instance, you may be having a painful UTI, a heavy period, or a stressful day. Or, this one's important, you may just not want to do it. The truth is that only about 25% of women report being able to climax through vaginal penetration alone. One more time for people in the back. Intercourse is not the sexual be-all and end-all for most women. It simply does not provide enough clitoral stimulation, which is a necessary piece for the pleasure puzzle for many vulvas. Then why is sex often considered an all-or-nothing game? So many of us are stuck in an archaic script based on heterosexual norms and a male-centered model of sexual pleasure. For couples in which sex doesn't involve one penis and one vagina, breaking free from this narrative has paid off. For example, women who have sex with other women are 20% more likely to report having orgasms than those who have sex with men. It's not their anatomy that's different, it's what they're doing. Broaden your thinking. If penetrative intercourse is not an option, or if you're just looking to spice things up by breaking free of an outdated script, I suggest that you first eliminate the term foreplay. That word indicates that there's a main event and everything that comes before it matters less. If this is how you're thinking about it, you're at risk of rushing through and missing the good stuff. Foreplay is sex. Let's talk about outer course, which is exactly what it sounds like. sex that stays outside of your orifices. It means touching, rubbing, massaging, licking, or playing with toys. It means making out, dry humping, cuddling. Outer course removes some of the pressure. A soft penis can feel plenty of delicious sensations. Many men can have orgasms without erections. And a vagina does not need to be lubricated for the vulva, the visible part of the female genitalia, to find pleasure and orgasm. Also keep in mind that countless other body parts, nipples, neck, inner thighs, and more, are packed with nerve endings and ready to be explored. The traditional narrative that goes intercourse orgasm we're done can lead to a pressure to perform sex that is unsatisfying overall, and let's be honest, the faking orgasms. Breaking free means increasing your communication game. Ask for what feels good to your unique body and give yourself the freedom to continue updating your sexual scripts throughout your lifetime. That article was Sex and Love, Beyond Intercourse by Rachel Czar, LMFT-CST. The next article is My Diagnosis, Why Did My Jaw Hurt For So Long? By Alyssa Rustic. My first symptom, a swollen, achy neck, could have been anything. But spring bloomed into summer, stranger things cropped up. A recurrent pinching sensation in my ears, sharp pains all around my face, and far worse than a tension headache, it felt as if a power drill was chiseling away at my temples. After a useless telehealth call with a general physician, I tracked down an ear, nose, and throat specialist, ENT, for another virtual appointment. She told me it might be a problem with my temporal mandibular joint, TMJ. We each have two of them, and they connect the lower jaw to the skull, allowing the mouth to move. I never had issues with my jaw, so I was skeptical. But the very next day, the pain struck hard again. It felt as if a rubber band had been tied around my jaw and was going to snap at any minute. I could barely brush my teeth. Even chewing solid food was a struggle. Soon I was subsisting on soups and smoothies, and this went on for a couple of months. Between that and my skyrocketing anxiety, I'd realized that my overall health was suffering, and I lost 15 pounds, which made me feel extremely weak. I found a dentist who agreed to see me in person, even during the pandemic, and I left with a pricey mouth guard and a prescription for 1,800 milligrams of ibuprofen a day. He told me to de-stress by taking a walk outside or reading a book. Not helpful. As another month passed, my pain grew worse. The tipping point. One day I yawned without thinking about it and heard an unsettling crack. The pain rushed back and I was terrified that I caused serious damage. Determined to find an empathetic medical professional, I did some digging and landed in the office of Nohan Bhaktari, DDS, a board-certified TMJ and oral facial pain specialist in New York City. Bhaktari spent more than an hour examining every aspect of my jaw, observing the way my mouth opened, closed, pinpointing pain spots along the way. He explained that the TMD, temporomandibular disorder, is an umbrella term for problems in the muscle joints and ligaments that involve functional jaw motions such as chewing and yawning. Yes, my TMJ was acting up, but it wasn't a simple case that ibuprofen could fix. He used an anatomical skull to show me what was happening. The thin piece of cartilage that sat between the head of my jawbone and my skull was slipping out of place. Because of that, I had a closed lock, meaning my jaw couldn't open with a full range of motion. That was likely aggravated by my unconsciously clenching my teeth during periods of stress and while sleeping. That triggered spasms in my facial muscles, which is why I felt so much pain and my headaches had worsened. And while these are not common TMD, can cause stuffiness, pain, ringing, and popping in the ears. The diagnosis. Bhaktari diagnosed me with muscle and joint pain, as well as an articular disc disorder of my right TMJ. He prescribed an orthotic, a specialized mouth guard, muscle relaxers to ease the spasms in my face, neck, and back, and 12 weeks of physical therapy. During my first physical therapy consultation, I cried, because I finally felt like I had support from experts who took my struggles seriously. You may feel pain again, but the goal is to make sure it never happens like the first flare, said Amy Delvecchio, DPT, OCS, my physical therapist at Pivotal Physical Therapy in New York City. And next time, you'll be more prepared to manage it. 10 months after my jaw first locked up, I'm out of physical therapy and nearly pain-free. I can now carefully eat a bagel, floss my teeth, wake up without headaches, and laugh without worry. There's lingering tension in my jaw and back, and my ears crackle occasionally, but my face is finally starting to feel like my own again. That was my diagnosis. Why Did My Jaw Hurt for So Long? By Alyssa Rustic. The next article is Meet Your Eyes by Adele Jackson Gibson. Focus, people, focus. Eye health is about more than 20/20 vision. 1. Built-in cameras. Your brain and your eyes work together to take continual snapshots of the world. The process works like this. Light passes through the colorless outer layer of your eye, the cornea, which directs it into the pupil at the center of the colorful iris. Another lens then projects the light onto the retina at the back of the eye. The retina has cells, rods, and cones that translate the light into nerve signals that travel along the optic nerve to the brain, so you can understand the colors and shapes you're seeing. Changes to any of these parts can make things blurry. If the eyeball grows too long, for instance, the light is focused in front of the retina, causing far-off objects to appear out of focus. There's nearsightedness. This is why glasses, contacts, and LASIK surgery are so handy. They help refocus the light where it needs to be. Unseen dangers. Even if you don't need glasses, see an eye doc regularly. Ophthalmologists can ID diseases like diabetes and macular degeneration, which damage the retina, and glaucoma, which injures the optic nerve. In the early stages of these conditions, you may not notice anything, but later you could experience sudden vision loss. Cataracts are more obvious and less scary. These appear at age 40, causing the lenses of the eye to become cloudy. Cataracts can be cleared up with corrective lenses or surgery. To avoid problems, add healthy habits to your eye exam routine. Eat produce rich in vitamins A, C, and E. Wear sunglasses to block damaging UV rays. And exercise and avoid smoking to maintain healthy blood pressure. Ask about your family history, too. Glaucoma tends to be hereditary and needs to be monitored. 3. Not a dry eye in the house. We normally blink about 15 times a minute to keep our eyes moist. When we do, the glands around the eyes release a mix of water, oil, and mucus, aka tears, to keep things lubricated. But when we stare at Zoom meetings on screen all day, that blink rate can slow to 5 times every 60 seconds. That's why our poor peepers get dry and red. It's not because they're tired from all the blue light. In fact, science says the small amount of blue light from screens is harmless to eye health. Because eye dryness and fatigue are more about not blinking enough, try the 20-20-20 rule. Every 20 minutes, take a break from your computer and look at something 20 feet away for 20 seconds. Doing this will keep your eyes lubed up. Artificial tears can also help in a pinch. That article was Meet Your Eyes by Adele Jackson Gibson. That concludes today's reading for February 2nd, 2021's episode of Prevention Magazine. This has been Herbert Gilmore for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.
It's 31 with fog. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the low 40s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is made available to the IAAIS Program Share and was recorded at the Audio Reading Service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome, this is Abel Living, and I'm your reader Kevin with the Audio Reading Service at the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Disability Scoop, And now I'll begin with Disability Discrimination in Healthcare Under Scrutiny, this article written by Sean Heasley. Federal officials are weighing a rewrite of regulations designed to ensure that people with disabilities do not face the discrimination from medical providers amid persistent concerns about unequal access. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights is issuing a request for information on disability discrimination in the healthcare and child welfare systems. The move comes as the agency said that it is aware that significant discrimination on the basis of disability against persons with disabilities persists in the nation's healthcare system and in its child welfare system. In addition to reports of discrimination that have surfaced during the course of HHS, OCR's own activities, officials said they've heard about issues from researchers, advocates, and disability organizations. As a result, HHS OCR is reviewing existing relevant regulations and mulling revisions. Now that the agency is looking for feedback on what any update should address, specifically, officials said they would like information about disability discrimination in the context of organ transplants, life-saving or life-sustaining care, suicide prevention and treatment, crisis standards of care, healthcare value assessment methodologies, child welfare, and the availability of auxiliary aids and accessible medical equipment. HHS OCR said it wants input from people with disabilities, their families, providers, disability advocates, hospitals, child welfare agencies, and other stakeholders. In addition to information on discrimination, the agency indicated that it would like to hear about the costs and administrative burdens related to various approaches to tackling the issue. We believe that persons with disabilities should not be discriminated against in vital health and human services, including organ transplants, suicide prevention, the provision of life-saving care and child welfare, said Roger Severino, director of HHS OCR. We believe the American public agrees that persons with disabilities deserve full protection under law, and we seek public input on achieving that goal with respect to the most consequential life-altering contexts. Once a request for information is published in the Federal Register, the public will have 60 days to submit comments. The next article, written by Michael Olaf from Stateline, entitled Pandemic Could Hurt Home-Based Care for Kids with 24/7 Needs. Midway through a conversation about her 14-year-old, Claire Jamie Davis Smith felt the need to change direction for a moment to highlight the happiness her daughter can experience. She does have a good relationship with her siblings, Smith said recently. She likes to have ice cream and go to the playground with them. She loves to go swimming and to movies. Despite all of the problems, she's very happy and lets us know what she likes and doesn't like. I think she deserves to grow up with her siblings, and her siblings deserve to grow up with her. Diagnosed with a chromosomal abnormality, so rare that it doesn't even have a name, Claire has epilepsy, chronic lung disease, asthma, and autism. Part of her brain is missing, her heart is in the wrong place, and she must wear a compression suit to keep other organs from misaligning. She is nonverbal and in diapers. She is trapped into a wheelchair and must be watched vigilantly in case she falls, which inevitably happens, causing broken bones. She also must be monitored throughout the night for signs of seizures, choking, and vomiting, which could prove fatal. My husband and I haven't had a full night's sleep in 14 years, Smith said. Claire has benefited from nearly 40-year-old Medicaid program, the Katie Beckett waiver program that enables families who earn too much to qualify for regular health care coverage to tap into home-based services. Without that aid, many families, including Claire's, likely would have to place their children in an institution. Tennessee this month became the 50th state to offer a Katie Beckett program or one like it, but the pandemic has worsened worker shortages in home health care, and advocates fear tightening budgets might mean cuts to the program. Smith lives in Washington, D.C., but she and her husband want to move to Maryland to take advantage of better special education opportunities for their other three children, two of whom have autism. But in Maryland, Claire would be waitlisted for the Katie Beckett program and might well age out of it before she is ever permitted to enroll. That has caused Smith's family to consider options they once regarded as unthinkable, putting Claire in foster care or breaking up the family to qualify for regular Medicaid. One well-meaning child welfare official in Montgomery County, Maryland, suggests another long-shot possibility, a GoFundMe page to cover the hundreds of thousands of dollars it costs annually to care for Claire at home. It's horrifying, it's inhumane, and it doesn't make any financial sense, said Smith. From my perspective, it seems that Maryland is hell-bent on breaking my family apart. Smith's Family Dilemma spotlights the shortcomings of Medicaid's home and community-based programs. In many states, enrollment is capped because of insufficient funding and a shortage of home health care workers. That shortage has deepened during the COVID-19 pandemic, as home nurses have taken better-paying jobs at hospitals. And now, with COVID-19 ravaging state budgets across the country and no prospect of help from Washington, some advocacy groups fear that there will be less money for home and community-based services. States and the federal government jointly fund Medicaid. Because they are optional services and a group of services that states spend a significant amount of money on, they are likely to be first on the chopping block when the states experience reductions in revenue, said Jessica Schubel, a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a progressive think tank based in Washington, D.C. Such cuts occurred after the Great Recession, she said. These programs' great expenses and low enrollment numbers make them tantalizing targets. Medicaid's home and community-based programs, including the Katie Beckett program, serve a small portion of the Medicaid population, less than 5.6% of the people enrolled in Medicaid. But because of the high cost of their care, they account for an outsized share of overall Medicaid spending, more than 15%. Before the pandemic, states spent more on Medicaid than any other single expenditure aside from K-12 education. Unemployment during COVID-19 has only increased Medicaid enrollment, further driving up state costs. Because Medicaid is an entitlement program, meaning that anybody who meets the eligibility requirements can enroll, it's difficult for states to find savings. Home and community-based services are one area in Medicaid programs in which states have a freer hand to reduce costs. The specific program that helps Claire is named for Katie Beckett, who was 4 months old in 1978 when she contracted viral encephalitis. It left her partly paralyzed, unable to swallow, and barely able to breathe on her own. Her parents wanted to care for her at home on a ventilator, but the costs were prohibitive and the family earned too much for Medicaid, which at the time didn't cover home health care in any case. Katie remained in a hospital in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, at a cost of $12,000 a month, six times what it would have taken to care for her at home. Her parents' lobbying, which eventually reached Ronald Reagan's White House, led to the creation of the Katie Beckett Waiver Program, which allows severely ill children to qualify for Medicaid reimbursement for medical services delivered in their homes, even if the family earns too much to qualify for regular Medicaid. In some states, recipients are eligible until they are 21, but the program ends sooner in others. Katie Beckett herself was able to benefit from the program. Katie did so well at home, her mother, Julie, said recently. At first, nurses didn't think she'd make it more than a couple of months, but she did. Beckett graduated from college, lived independently while continuing to receive home health care through an adult Medicaid home health care program, and held a series of jobs. She did die in 2012 at the age of 34. Some states take all children who qualify, but in a 2018 survey, the Kaiser Family Foundation identified five states with wait lists: Connecticut, Maryland, Oregon, Texas, and Utah. Charles Gishlar, a spokesman for the Maryland Department of Health, said the state caps enrollment in its version of the Katie Beckett program at 200 children and currently has a wait list of 164. That wait list has increased over the years, he said, more than doubling since 2013. Virginia was not on Kaiser's list, but it also had a wait list several years ago when Carol Coleman tried to get services for her daughter, Justice, who had cerebral palsy and required tube feeding, an ostomy, and catheterization. Stuck on the list, the family got limited help but not money for medical equipment, nursing care, or modifications to their house to make care easier. Justice died at age 11 in 2017. Coleman is now a project director for Family Voices, a support network that helps families with medically fragile children find support services. Coleman said there should be federal standards for Medicaid home-based services. Would we benefit by having more standards and not so much variation across states, she said? Yes, and that would mean people wouldn't be shopping for Medicaid programs across the state lines and not having to look at options like divorcing or going into debt or having their children go without. but even qualifying for the program is no guarantee a child will get needed services. In many parts of the country, particularly in rural areas, there aren't enough skilled home care workers to meet the need. There aren't enough boots on the ground, said Tara Ann Pleat, an attorney in upstate New York who represents families with children with special needs. That's where everything gets hung up. The enrollment is available, but effectiveness is something else. There's just not enough manpower to provide meaningful support. Dr. Roy Maynard, medical director of Pediatric Home Service Minnesota, which provides in-home care, said his company recently conducted a retention survey and found that only 15% of its nurses remained on the job after 2 years. Maynard said agencies like this, hamstrung by low Medicaid reimbursement rates, can't pay as much for nurses as hospitals can. Imagine being a business and you turn over 85% in 24 months, Maynard said. Just imagine how that works. Maynard has co-authored studies suggesting that as a result of improved technology that can keep children with severe medical conditions alive, the population of children who would benefit from home health care services is growing. Pleat and others say the pandemic, which has prompted hospitals to hire more nurses to replace those who have fallen ill, has deepened nursing shortages. That is why she, Maynard, and others in the home health care field dread the prospect of states further lowering Medicaid reimbursement rates as a cost savings response to their strained budgets. No states have yet indicated they're targeting home services as state legislatures begin their sessions, where dealing with their tight state budgets will be a top priority. Gishlar, with the Maryland Health Department, said in an email that the state does not anticipate cutting program services, nor has the state cut services during prior economic downturns. In fact, he added, Maryland has implemented 2-4% rate increases within the last 6 months. Smith, Claire's mother, said her daughter has an excellent caregiver, but it is hard to find a substitute when that caregiver can't work. That has gotten worse during the pandemic. She described the service Claire receives through Katie Beckett program as a lifeline, not only for Claire, but for Smith and her husband as well. Both are attorneys. He works for labor union in Washington, D.C. She has done some teaching, freelance legal work, and writing, but largely put her career on hold after Claire's birth. The family has health insurance through the union, but it does not cover the extraordinary costs of Claire's care, Smith said. Claire's medical care would easily exceed the amount the two brings in. Through the Katie Beckett program, Claire and her family have received hearing aids, a wheelchair, and a hospital bed that is essential for helping Claire breathe at night. Claire also gets a personal care assistant for 14 to 15 hours a day. It also helps pay for the thousands of dollars of co-payments for Claire's medicine, home therapy, and numerous doctor visits, all of which help to minimize what Smith said would be far costlier hospitalizations. The decision to move across the border to Maryland is not one Smith and her husband take lightly. They feel that their children are suffering because of what they regard as deficient special education services in D.C. They contemplated putting Claire in foster care, which would make her eligible for all the Medicaid home services she gets now. They also have consulted with lawyers about the possibility of divorcing and the family living apart, with Jamie retaining custody of Claire and qualifying for Medicaid. The choices the family faces, including putting Claire in an institution, Smith said, are cruel and nonsensical. It seems hopeless, and I can't figure out the rationale because everyone agrees it costs more and leads to worse health outcomes, Smith said. She paused and added, I don't know how I'd explain why any of this to the other kids. Our next article, entitled CDC Study Pinpoints Prevalence of Intellectual Disability, it's written by Michelle Diament of Disability Scoop. Researchers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are offering up a new estimate of the number of American children with intellectual disability. In a study looking at 8-year-olds in several communities across the nation, CDC researchers found that 1.2% had IQ scores of 70 or below, qualifying them for an intellectual disability diagnosis. The findings published late last year in the Disability Health Journal are based on data collected through the CDC's Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, which regularly reviews health and educational records for 8-year-olds in selected communities. The CDC uses the same methods to determine its autism prevalence estimates, which are generally updated every 2 years. For the study, researchers looked at records for over 215,000 children in 9 states in 2014, identifying children as having intellectual disabilities if they had an IQ score of 70 or less or if there was a written statement from a qualified professional indicating that the child's intellectual functioning fell within that range. The vast majority of children identified, 78%, had mild intellectual disability, while 12% were classified in the moderate category. 1% were considered severe or profound. Researchers did not have precise IQ scores for the remaining children and could not specify severity. Intellectual disability was about twice as likely in boys compared to girls and in black children compared to white kids. Prevalence also varied dramatically by location, with Arkansas at the high end seeing double the cases of Minnesota and Tennessee, which reported the lowest rates. Of the children with intellectual disability, the study found that 39% also had autism. Even though most cases of intellectual disability can be reliably diagnosed before age 5, the researchers noted that almost a quarter of the children studied did not undergo an IQ test until after age 6. The researchers said their findings are largely consistent with previous estimates of intellectual disability prevalence, which were based on surveys, administrative records, or data from single states, but those prior studies lacked details on subpopulations. The study authors indicated that given the substantial disparities seen across racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic groups, that the results could be used to help inform strategies to enhance early access to intervention services to improve quality of life for children with ID. Next article written by George Avalos of the Mercury News. It's called Backed by Google, Inclusive Housing Projects Move Forward. It's datelined out of San Jose, California. An affordable housing project in San Jose has moved closer to reality with a new loan and the developer's purchase of the properties where the homes will be built. The Kelsey Air Station has landed more financing from Google, and the project's developer has just completed a purchase of the properties needed for the 115-unit development, according to public documents filed in Santa Clara County on January 15th. Google has allowed us to accelerate our development plans and keep the project going, said Michaela Connery, founder and chief executive officer of the Kelsey, a co-developer of the Kelsey Hour Station. Acting through an affiliate, the Kelsey paid just over $3 million to purchase four parcels on North First Street near Fox Avenue on the north edge of downtown San Jose, the property records show. Google Endeavor, a unit of Alphabet, the owner of search giant Google, completed a financing package for the pre-development stages of the project, county documents show. With the fallout from COVID-19 worsening the housing crisis, we're investing more in the Kelsey Air Station to bring it closer to the next phase of development, said Michael Appel, a spokesperson for Google. We're looking forward to construction beginning this summer as the project moves forward. The new development is designed to be fully accessible for anyone with physical, sensory, or intellectual disabilities, according to Connery. Google Endeavor has provided $6.9 million in financing. When we made our first investment in 2019, we did so to help create more affordable housing in San Jose and an inclusive community for those who are often overlooked in the affordable housing conversation, adults with developmental and other disabilities, Apple said. The $6.9 million in financing consists of $5.3 million in the very early stages of the project in 2019 and $1.3 million in the most recent loan, which was recorded on January 15th. I give Google a lot of credit for coming up with funding early in the project when there were still a lot of unknowns about Kelsey Air Station, Connery said. The next major step, to land state and federal tax credits that will complete the initial stage of the financing of the project. Once the tax credits are obtained, it should be possible to land the financing to actually build the Kelsey Air Station. Connery estimated construction should begin somewhere around June or July. Julie Mahawald, chief financial officer with Housing Trust Silicon Valley, believes that Google's interest and involvement in the project have been crucial in the development's success. Housing Trust manages a fund that invests in affordable homes in the Bay Area, including loans provided by Google Endeavor. Google took the time to understand the project and how creative it is, Mahawald said. The Kelsey Air Station will offer a mix of two-bedroom and apartment studios. It is being developed with units that are affordable to people with a wide range of incomes. The building is going to be affordable across a range of extremely low incomes to moderate income, Connery said. Based on the area median income for Santa Clara, it's possible the units would be rented to people with annual wages ranging from $33,150 to $78,850. About 30% of the units will be offered for less than $500 a month. We're seeing that Google is committed to the development of as many affordable homes as possible in San Jose and other cities in the Bay Area, Malawad said. The next story, entitled Disability Representation on TV Breaks Record, and it's written by Sean Heasley of Disability Scoop. Characters with disabilities are set to account for a larger percentage of those on primetime television shows this season than ever before, according to an analysis. Of the 773 regularly appearing characters expected on broadcast scripted series during the 2020-2021 season, 3.5% have disabilities. That marks a new high, exceeding last year's record of 3.1%. The figure comes from an annual report out this month from GLAAD, a media advocacy organization for the gay and lesbian community that looks at representation of various minority groups, including those with disabilities, on television. The analysis tracks characters expected on scripted primetime shows airing on ABC, CBS, The CW, Fox, and NBC. The representation of characters with disabilities this season is the highest it's been since GLAAD began keeping records 11 years ago. But the record indicates that television still falls far short of including people with disabilities in proportion to their numbers in the actual population. This comes as Sarah Kate Ellis, president and CEO at GLAAD, notes that television has become even more central to people's lives. In the midst of a destructive pandemic, a long overdue cultural reckoning with racial injustice, and a transition into a new political era for this country, representation matters more than ever as people turn to entertainment storytelling for connection and escape, she said. Across the networks, NBC has the most characters with disabilities in its lineup of 18. Meanwhile, there were three each on ABC, CBS, two on the CW, and just one on Fox. Characters include a surgeon with autism at ABC's The Good Doctor and a boy with cerebral palsy on Fox's 911. The next article by Michelle DeMint, entitled Biden Pandemic Strategy Puts Focus on People with Disabilities. As President Joe Biden introduces a coordinated federal approach to address the COVID-19 pandemic, he's turning attention to the virus's impact on people with disabilities. Biden laid out a broad 200-page plan and signed a slew of executive orders late last week to increase access to vaccines, requires masks in certain settings, and implements a host of other moves in the face of a raging pandemic. Among the many changes he announced are several aimed at curtailing the coronavirus' outsized impact on the disability community. The White House said focused guidance on COVID-19 for people with disabilities will be coming from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the administration is promising greater assistance to intermediate care facilities for people with disabilities and increased support for those receiving home and community-based services. Another major change is the federal government will collect data on how COVID-19 is affecting people with disabilities. Disability advocates had long sought such data, arguing that it's not possible to properly address a problem that goes unmeasured. Separately, the Biden plan calls for a detailed technical guidance to be released in the coming weeks from the U.S. Department of Education and the CDC on how to safely reopen schools that will include information on serving students and staff with disabilities or those who are immunocompromised. And the strategy includes a commitment to establish new models to get vaccines to high-risk individuals, specifically including institutions for those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and to work with the CDC to review concerns about vaccine guidelines for people with disabilities and other groups. And speaking about his national strategy, Biden acknowledged that things will take time. We didn't get into this mess overnight, and it's going to take months for us to turn things around, but let me be equally clear. We will get through this. We will defeat this pandemic, Biden said. Help is on the way. Well, that's all the time we have for today. And this has been Kevin with Able Living. Hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Center Solutions Podcast, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Hello, this is Michael, reading another article from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, published Saturday, February 6th, 2021. Midland Unified Command Team opens second mass vaccination site, from staff reports. The Midland Unified Command Team will open a second mass vaccination site at Golf Course Road Church of Christ Family Center, 3500 West Golf Course Road, on February 15th. Administration for phases 1A and 1B individuals by appointment only will continue. The Midland County Horseshoe Backstage location, 2514 Arena Trail, also will remain open for second dose administration. If a person received his or her first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine at the Horseshoe Backstage location, he or she will return to that same location for a second dose at that person's scheduled appointment time. Those people who qualify as phases 1A, healthcare workers, or 1B, over 65 and or diagnosed with a chronic disease, can register to get on this list for this distribution and future allocations of the COVID-19 vaccine by visiting midlandhealth.org/vaccine and clicking on the Click to Register button. Detailed information defining the populations included in these phases is available on the above mentioned website. If a person has had COVID-19 and wants the vaccine, the CDC recommends he or she be fully recovered and 14 days past the quarantine period. Currently, the state of Texas has put an increased emphasis on vaccinating those 75 and over. If a person falls in this age category, it is highly encouraged that a person to get registered for the vaccine. Once on the waiting list, a person will be assigned an appointment time and date and receive an email, text message, and or phone call with the information needed. This communication will come from support@healthipass.com, phone number 855-897-1447 for text messages, or 221-1111 for phone calls. After a person has a confirmed date and time for a vaccine, he or she must make sure they complete all the forms online that are sent prior to arriving for the vaccine. People should take a valid picture ID with them to appointments, arrive on time, and wear a short sleeve or sleeveless shirt. If a jacket is needed, make sure it is easy to remove. When arriving to Golf Course Road Church of Christ, enter the parking lot from Tarleton Street and follow signage and volunteers to the west side parking lot. A map of the location is available at midlandhealth.org/vaccine. If unable to drive, Easy Rider will be using Midland Route Number 2 to drop off at that vaccine location. Bus routes are available at www.ez-rider.org/routes.html. For further questions, visit midlandhealth.org/vaccine.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, February 5th, 2021. Mass effort continues next week. The mass vaccination effort at Ratliff Stadium is over for this week as health officials report that more than 13,000 have been vaccinated in the joint local effort. The clinic will continue next week starting on Wednesday for those seeking the first of two Pfizer COVID-19 vaccinations. Health officials stressed not to go to Ratliff seeking a second shot as those will be scheduled after February 14th at local urgent cares and not at Ratliff Stadium. It is still best to register online prior to getting in line at Ratliff as it will cut wait time. Medical Center Hospital Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Abbott-Timmons said information on how those who have already received the first dose will get the second dose will be released Monday. She said the second shots will be at urgent cares and that no one will have to wait in a crowded area and that all precautions will be taken to keep patients safe and adhere to social distancing. Odessa Regional Medical Center's Chief Medical Officer, Rohith Saravanan, explained that the Pfizer vaccine second dose is meant to be administered 17 to 21 days following the first dose. The Moderna second vaccine is meant to be administered 28 to 34 days after the first shot. Saravanan explained that guidance from the CDC details that a second dose can be administered up to 42 days after the first shot and still be effective. The Ratliff Clinic has only used Pfizer shots so far, and Timmons explained that due to the mass production by Pfizer, that it seems to be the most readily available. Saravanan also addressed when full immunity happens following the second dose. About a week to 2 weeks after the second dose, he said, adding that immunity is personal and that even after that occurs, that social distancing and masks are still needed to protect others who are not immune. MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin praised the volunteers at Ratliff. He said they have requested 5,000 more vaccines per week on top of the 3,900 they are currently getting. Tippin did say the weather could be a factor next week at Ratliff and urged Odessans